Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you today from Longmont, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This is part three of the financial literacy mini-series. In the previous episode, part two on podcast episode 56, I discussed the asset side of the net worth statement. In this episode, I will conclude the discussion of the net worth statement by covering liabilities and the calculation of net worth. So let's get started. If you recall, we talked about the money journal in the first episode. We talked about income and savings for your goals and then living on the difference, and those savings goals will be converted into assets that we talked about in the last episode. And today we're going to talk about liabilities. So let's start off with what are liabilities? Liabilities are effectively any money you owe, so debt. And they can be broken into two categories on the net worth statement: short-term liabilities and long-term liabilities. Short-term liabilities are those that are due within 12 months, typically. And long-term liabilities will be those liabilities that have final due dates beyond 1 year. So those types of debts that will take you more than a year to pay off. Let's start the discussion with short-term liabilities. And the one that typically comes to mind for most people is credit cards. And that's what I have listed here under short-term debt. That is usually what most people are associating with any debt that is due within a year. And hopefully you don't have any outstanding debts on credit cards, because those interest rates are pretty significant. They average between 20 and 30%, and many store cards can be up towards the upper end of that range. And today, many interest rates are in the mid 20% area. So if you use a credit card for its convenience and you don't pay it off in full every month, you are going to be charged interest on those purchases from the day that you make that purchase going forward. Even if you paid off at the end of the month but had a balance in the prior month, you're going to pay interest on those charges that occurred that month. So the key here, if you are going to use credit cards, and there are a lot of benefits to using credit cards, and we can talk about the advantages and disadvantages in a moment, but if you use them for convenience sake, I highly, highly recommend you pay them off in full every month. Kind of view them as like a debit card. And the only way you can really make sure you're on top of it is to track all of your charges on those cards as they occur. And one way to do that, and this is how I do it, is to set up automatic notifications on the credit card websites that, in my case, what I do is I set it up for any charge over a penny. So all charges, I get a text and it gives me that extra like, oh yeah, I did spend money on that. Even if it was an automatic payment, for instance, for like a Netflix or something that it gets automatically charged once a month. And then I track all of that. So when the bill comes at the end of the month, I'm not surprised by how much is due on that card. And I make sure there's enough in my checking account to pay it. So I use my credit cards as you would a debit card. So the advantages of using a credit card are there are reward programs. You can earn cashback rewards. You can earn points for travel. If you needed to rent a car, typically they are going to require a credit card. Same with a hotel stay. Typically, it's often difficult to rent a hotel room if you don't have a credit card. You don't have to carry a bunch of cash around. You can purchase items before you have cash, but you could view that as an advantage, but I wouldn't view that as an advantage necessarily. Now, the disadvantages are, as we said, the interest rates are quite high if you were to carry a balance. So definitely a major disadvantage of credit cards. It's also somewhat of a disadvantage using credit cards because people tend to use credit cards more easily than they will if they had to purchase an item with cash. It kind of doesn't feel as hurtful, I guess you would say, when you purchase something with a credit card. But again, if you have those notices and you're keeping track, maybe that's not such the case, but it is often a surprise to people when they receive their credit card statement and they're shocked at how much they spent that month. So you really need to keep on top of it. I like to track all of my charges on the credit cards as they occur and then make sure, obviously, I have enough in my checking account to pay them in full. And I do set up payment balance in full as an option on my credit card so that they're automatically paid in full every month. And I don't even have to log in to pay them. They're automatically paid. But of course, that means you need to make sure you have enough money in your checking account to pay for it. Now, to show you how challenging credit cards can be, I guess you would say from an interest perspective, I like to use the example, if you were to purchase something for, let's say, $2,500, like a mountain bike or fancy TV or piece of furniture, and it was on a credit card that had a 23% annual percentage rate, APR, your interest for 1 year would be $575 on that $2,500 purchase. And most minimum payments on credit cards are quite low. Usually it is the interest amount plus 1% of the balance or $25, whichever is greater. So if we were to use this example of $2,500 on a credit card at 23% and you didn't make any additional purchases, this is the other important thing. All you did was make that one purchase and you paid the minimum payment, it would take you 163 months to pay that off, which is 13 and a half years. Your total interest would be $3,700. So the total cost of that $2,500 item would be $6,200, more than twice the cost of the product itself. And obviously after 13 years, it's probably worth nothing at that point. So you need to be really careful about paying the minimum payment. That is definitely a way to just stay on that credit card treadmill, which some people get on and can't get off. So you need to be very careful of that. The average credit card balance for a household in 2025 is actually $7,321. So using that same math, if that household has that balance and charged nothing else going forward, which would be unlikely, but if they did and had that same minimum payment mindset, I guess you would say, it would take them 270 months to pay it off, 22 and a half years. The total interest would be $12,941. So the total cost, including the average balance of $7,300, it would be over $20,000 to pay off that $7,000 balance. So you can see how people get trapped in this credit card treadmill, which is what the banks want you to do, right? They want you to pay your obligation, your minimum payment, but they would like you to just keep that out there, that outstanding debt for a long period of time. So enough wind about credit cards. So let's just go with, you can use them. They have advantages. Pay them off in full. Use them like a debit card. Set it up for automatic payment in full and be done with it. And then you will be that user of the credit cards that I wouldn't say the banks hate, because they still get the interchange fee when you swipe a credit card. They get a small piece of it from the store or entity that you're buying the product from, but they're not earning the interest on you. And you might get the rewards and cash back and things like that. So that's the way to use credit cards if you're going to use them. All right, let's jump to long-term debt. That would be things like student loans, auto loans, mortgages. So let's jump a little bit into student loans because, again, this series is geared towards young individuals, many of whom may be going to college soon or potentially in college and are faced with the potential of having to borrow money with student loans. So there is something called the Federal Student Loan Program. You can go to studentaid.gov to learn more about it. You have to fill out the FAFSA, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid form, in order to be eligible. There is no underwriting requirement. There is no credit report pulled or anything like that. As long as you fill out the FAFSA and you're a student, you're eligible for these loans. They typically have relatively attractive interest rates. A number of years ago, they were very, very low, but as interest rates have increased, so have the rates on these federal student loans. For the period between July 1st, 2025 and June 30th, 2026, for any distributions made under the loan program, the undergraduate loan rate is 6.39%. There is also a loan fee of 1.057%, and all of this is outlined on the studentaid.gov website. And if you're a graduate student, the rates are a little bit higher, 7.94%, with that same loan application fee of 1.057%. There are direct subsidized loans, which are need-based loans, and there are direct unsubsidized loans, which is non-need-based and available to all students. And the difference is, in essence, the subsidized loans, the U.S. Department of Education pays the interest while you're attending school and for 6 months afterwards, and then the interest accrues at that point. For direct unsubsidized loans, no payments are required while you're in school, but the interest is accruing. The limits are, if you're an undergraduate and dependent, meaning that you are on your parents' tax return and you're dependent of your parents, for example, in the first year, you can borrow up to $5,500. In the second year, you can borrow up to $6,500. And any year thereafter, you can borrow up to $7,500 with a total maximum across all of the years of $31,000. If you are a undergraduate and independent, which is not common, so you're paying your own bills, you're not a dependent of your parents, those limits are higher, and they are $9,500 for the first year, $10,500 for the second year, and $12,500 for each year thereafter with a maximum of $57,500. If you were getting an unsubsidized federal student loan and you borrowed $5,500 as a freshman, you would owe a little over $7,000 after 6 months after graduation, so 4.5 years later, if you were to graduate in 4 years. So that interest would be accruing. For graduate students, the amounts are much, much higher, and it's $20,500 per year for a maximum of $138,500. Now, you hear people about kind of getting into student loan debt situations where they can't dig out of. Typically, it's a result of taking loans at the graduate level where that maximum borrowed amount is $138,500 on top of the undergraduate amount, which very likely they would have borrowed the full $31,000, for example, or close to it. And that's where people get into very large student loan balances, and then the interest is accruing, and they're paying under programs that allow them to pay less than the amount that would need to be paid in order just to pay the interest every year, so the balance grows and so forth. So the key here is really not to overextend yourself on student loans. A rule of thumb in kind of the financial planning community is try not to come out of school with more student loan debt than what you would expect to earn in your first year out of school. So that's kind of a nice rule of thumb. If you were to borrow the maximum amount under the direct federal student loan program for dependent students of $31,000, likely you're going to be able to handle that. But if you get to the point where you're borrowing for graduate school or a master's program or a nursing program or a doctorate program or a legal program, that's when you can kind of get saddled with a lot of debt, and you need to be really careful about that. Now, many students aren't able to cover all of the cost of college with just the federal student loans for the undergraduate student. So many parents will also borrow under the Direct Plus program, which is parent loan for undergraduate students. Those do require underwriting, so the parent does need to qualify for the loan. The rates are higher. They're 8.94% currently, and the loan fee or application fee is 4.228%, so it's pretty high. These are the obligation of the parent, whereas the federal student loan for undergraduate students is the obligation of the student. So be aware that if you take out federal student loans and you're a student, that loan is your obligation to repay, whereas the Direct Plus loan is the obligation of the parent. There are also private loans out there. Those tend to be variable rate loans, and they are sometimes lower rates initially, but because they're variable rates, they could rise over time with interest rates if they were to go up. And so that's kind of the student loan landscape. And then let's jump to auto loans real briefly, auto loans and mortgages. Those loans today are around 10% for new cars and up to around 14% for used cars. And it really is highly dependent on your credit score. And we'll talk about credit scores in another episode. But if you have good credit, your rates will be much lower. If you have bad credit, they could be much, much higher. The terms of auto loans tend to be 4 to 7 years. And this is what you will find if you were to walk into a dealer. They will typically focus on monthly payment. They will often ask you, how much a month can you afford? And in my opinion, they're kind of playing games with the loan amortization schedule, I guess you would say. So for example, you could, let's say, buy a car and you had a $20,000 auto loan. It might be hard today to find a car cheap enough to only have a $20,000 auto loan, but let's just roll with it. A $20,000 auto loan at 9% over 36 months, the monthly payment would be $635. And so let's say you're in a dealership and they're like, oh yeah, well, this would cost you $636 to get into this car today with this $20,000 loan. And you say, whoa, that's a lot of money. I can't afford that. And then they say, oh, let me go talk to my manager and see what we can do. And then he comes back and says, what if I could lower that payment to $360? And you're like, oh, wow, this guy's great. What a pal. He's really helped me out. All they did was they extended the loan. Instead of being paid back in 36 months, it's paid back in 72 months at the same rate. Now, of course, a longer term might actually have a higher rate, but let's just assume that the interest rate is the same. And it would lower the payment to $360.51 per month. But now you have twice as many payments to make. And in the first example, you would have paid a little less than $3,000 in interest on that $20,000 loan. But in the second example, over 72 months, you'll pay almost $6,000 in interest for that same $20,000 loan. Yes, your monthly payment was lower, but your total cost is much higher. So very important, anytime you take a loan out of any type, to understand all of the terms. How much are you borrowing? What is the monthly payment? What is the interest rate? Over how many months or years are you paying this loan back? And what is the total cost, the total amount of interest you're paying, plus the repayment of the original principal? So super important to pay attention to and not fall for the sale gimmicks, I guess you would say. Let's go to home mortgages. So that would be the other kind of long-term loan that you might have at some point in the future. And those kind of come in three different flavors, I guess you would say, really two flavors. The first is a fixed rate loan, and the second is adjustable rates, but those fixed rates usually are either in a 30-year term or a 15-year term. And as of November 20th of 2025, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage was 6.36%. The 15-year fixed rate mortgage, because you're paying it off sooner, is a little lower at 5.85%. There's also what's called adjustable rate mortgages, or ARMs, and they have variable rates. So typically they will be fixed for a period of time, and then they will be variable from that time forward, but they're usually amortized over 30 years. So the way it would work is, let's say it's a 7-1 ARM, meaning that it's fixed for 7 years. And then each year thereafter, the interest rate will adjust based on prevailing interest rates. So a 7-year ARM as of November 20th, 2025 was 6.05%. So you can see it's kind of in between what the 15-year fixed rate and the 30-year fixed rate is currently. Now, a lot of people will move within 7 years, so maybe that's not so harmful. But if you were to stay in that house, you don't know what your payment is going to be after that seventh year. It could be much higher, potentially could be lower, but there is a risk that it could go up quite a bit if rates were to further increase. So that's kind of how it works. And typically, mortgages require a 20% down payment. Otherwise, you're required to take private mortgage insurance, otherwise known as PMI. And there is an additional charge on that, which is basically an insurance premium of 0.3% to 1.5% of the loan amount, depending on where you stand in that down payment. You can put down less on a house than 20%, but you will have to pay private mortgage insurance. So that does increase your costs overall. Now, once the value of the home increases to a point where you have more than 20% equity, you can get that removed. But typically, you have to wait a period of time to request that, and you have to have proof that the equity in your home exceeds that 20%. The lower your down payment, the higher the risk of owning a home is, because you can put down as little as 3.5% on an FHA mortgage. But if that house were to go down by 5%, let's say, and you had to sell it, or even if it didn't go down at all, but you had to sell it and you had to pay closing costs of 6%, which sounds high, but that may just be the broker fee, the fee that you have to pay the brokers to sell your home, you could be upside down, which means that not only did you lose your down payment, but you may have to come up with more money at the closing just to affect the sale. So you need to be very careful about putting very little down on a house because it's an extremely highly leveraged transaction. So those are the main types of loans. So let's go back to the net worth statement and let's talk about how these are organized on that net worth statement. So you would have short-term debt listed at the top of the liabilities, and that would typically be things like credit cards, or if you had a home equity line of credit, that might go there. Long-term debt would be things like student loans, auto loans, mortgages. I like to organize them in the order of how recently they are due. So you might have student loans that are shorter term than auto loans or vice versa. And mortgages will typically be your longest loan. So I kind of like to put them in that order. And then when we go back to calculating net worth, now we have everything on our net worth statement that we need to calculate what our net worth is. We had all of our assets that we listed last time, what you own on the left-hand side. We now have all of the liabilities on the right-hand side. And here's the thing about the liabilities, and this is the same with the assets. They're as of a point in time. So when you're listing your liabilities, you need to use that same date that you were using for your net worth statement. So let's say, and we were talking about a September 30th net worth statement. So you would need to get the statements for your credit cards, student loans, auto loans, mortgages, or what other kind of debt you have as of that date. So even if you pay your credit cards off in full every month, but they have a balance on them as of that date, because the due date is after that date, for example, you do want to put that amount on the net worth statement. So the amount of the credit card balance that you have as of that date, even if you're paying it off in full with your checking account, because that money was picked up on the asset side of the net worth statement in your checking account. So even though it's shown as a debt, but it's paid off every month, you still want to show the amount as of the date of the net worth statement. And then once you have all of your assets totaled up and all of your liabilities totaled up, you can calculate net worth. Simply assets minus liabilities equals net worth. What you own minus what you owe is what you're worth. Now, the one thing that you may notice that isn't on the net worth statement, maybe you are a new student, you don't have a lot of assets, you don't have many investments, if any, you don't have many use assets, you don't own a home, maybe you have a car, maybe you don't, and you have this student loan, let's say, and maybe that's it. And you say, my net worth is negative. Yeah, you can actually have a negative net worth. If your liabilities exceed your assets, you would have negative net worth. But don't fret, because the one thing you don't see on your asset side of your ledger is your ability to earn income. That's effectively an asset, but it's not an asset that you calculate on the net worth statement. So you may have gone to school and borrowed some money, but hopefully you did it with the thought of being able to get a job or a career that's going to pay off the debt that you took on to get the education to get that job. And that is truly an asset that does not show up on the net worth statement. So don't fret if you have negative net worth at the outset. just work to improve that, get it to a positive net worth, and ultimately grow it over time. So it is very common for young people to start out with negative net worth and then get to a positive net worth situation and grow it further in the future. So I do want to point that out, that net worth can be a negative figure. Assets minus liabilities equals net worth. All right. So now we've wrapped up the net worth statement and we've wrapped up the money journal. Next time, we're going to go into compounding, which is my favorite subject. And we will also talk a little bit about credit scores and credit reports. So until the next episode, I hope you have a great week or a few days, because these are coming out sporadically over the next couple of weeks. And enjoy. And I'll see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. Now, for that all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.